So anyway, this talk wanted to be very interactive. In some sense, what I did is decide not to design a talk for this group. Decide to give my, I guess in the context in the, the current era, my stump talk, my standard stump talk. And so you can ask me questions, and what I'll try to do is I'll try to then, talk about something else interesting and steer you away from the actual question that you asked. So you don't forget what question you asked, okay, but you're still interested in my answer, okay?
Everybody had to submit a question before they could come.
Right, and, and Lars will moderate here. Okay, so. So please, this is an interactive break-in at any time. In some sense, I don't know what you're interested in. From some of the questions I've gotten, some people are interested in actually, how does Lisa do things? Other people are interested in its capabilities. Got slides about both. We can take this anywhere you want. Okay. So first of all, Lisa, for the uninitiated, is three spacecraft. They're in an Earth-trailing orbit, and they're separated by about 5 million kilometers, okay, each of the spacecraft. So this is a mission to detect gravitational waves. And on the simplest level, the gravitational waves are detected by measuring the changes in distance between fiducial masses in each of the spacecraft. Okay, so there are mirrored masses about that size, two of them in each spacecraft. You bounce light off of them and use them as reference surfaces. So this is being done as a joint project between NASA and ESA, which makes it interesting. It has a launch date of 2012 plus, and I'll bet heavily on the plus. Some of the targets or sort of observational objectives that we can talk about today are mergers of massive black holes. It's certainly something that the group here has been talking about so far this season. Something that probably hasn't been touched on quite as much is inspiral of stellar mass compact objects into massive black holes, which is quite interesting. Something that's near and dear to the hearts of some people here are the ultra-compact binary systems, and we expect to see thousands of those with LISA. And then possibly a gravitational wave from the early universe, but by no means certain.
Okay, I've got a question.
Yeah, go
ahead. When I used to listen to talks by Peter Bender, I used to get the impression that you just give him enough money, you'll go into Radio Shack and buy all the components, put it together. It's not sort of implausible. What's the single biggest?
Good question.
Problem.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. How are we away from it, and how are we going to test it?
Right. Okay. And so I'll answer that now, and we'll get into it more later in the talk if you want to. And I think the answer to that is, first of all, let's compare it to LIGO, which is kind of operating right now. Okay. LISA, in some ways, experimentally, if you were able to build it on Earth, it would be easier than LIGO. And for a very simple reason, LIGO is has arms that are about 5 kilometers long. When you take into account the bounces, they're effectively about 50 kilometers long. And you're trying to do about the same fractional measurement of strain, about 10 to the minus 21 to 10 to the minus 22, someplace in that region. So obviously with LIGO, you have to measure displacements that are much, much smaller, roughly about 100,000 times smaller than you do with LISA. So LISA itself doesn't have that problem. Okay, so with LISA, the problem is that it's operating at much lower frequencies. And so we don't know nearly as much about disturbances at low frequencies. Okay. And most of what we know about materials and so forth is actually at higher frequencies. So that's number one. So problem number one is that we're measuring at a fundamentally lower frequency band where not as much is known about materials creep and many other issues. So that's one.
But this doesn't look like a materials creep.
Yeah, there is, but we can get into that. Secondly, there's just the issue that LIGO, was commissioned, right? And then now we're roughly at least 2 years later, maybe three. And just now, it's getting to its initial design sensitivity. So LISA, pretty much, you send it up. You've got no screwdrivers up there. You have to turn it on, and pretty much it has to work. And I think that's the big problem, is designing something, okay, that works essentially the first time you put it into orbit. That's true of any space experiment, but when you're trying to do a precision experiment in space, it's more difficult. So I think Pete's right in a sense that, in some sense, there is this Radio Shack, sort of build it in your garage type of attitude. But at the same time, to do it right the first time without touching it, I think is a much more difficult problem.
So it's reliability?
It's reliability. It's also the fact that you take an aerospace manufacturer, okay, and they're used to building a certain type of spacecraft. And those spacecraft can have, you know, if they have a loose bolt inside of them, nothing happens. With this, if you have a loose bolt inside of it, okay, you don't want loose bolts, because loose bolts themselves have enough gravitational interaction with the proof masses to mess up your measurement. Okay, so the issues here are, how do you build a precision measurement system in space? If you're going to build it again on the ground, and you had control over all the laboratories, and you were able to work at it over time, not hard at all, I think. But it's putting it in space.
What's that?
Drag-free? Certainly, drag-free is a challenge. Okay, and I'll talk more about that. Okay, so that's kind of laying out the picture. I think it's the fact that this is being done in space that's difficult, not so much the intrinsic technology behind it. Now I'll get more into that.
When you say build in space, do you mean build in space or build here?
Built here and then built here. Yeah, no, this is not going to be built in space. No astronauts touching this, absolutely not. Okay, so we'll get into it a little bit more. So what's that? Yeah, good. No, this is good. So those are some of the things, you know, I usually talk about. Get a couple of notations, two polarizations of gravitational waves. That's useful to know, one sort of stretching this way, the other one stretching in the 45, rotated by 45 degrees. Strain is essentially delta L over L. What you do typically with all these things are eventually based on sort of laser interferometry. And what you do in, say, a Michelson interferometer is you have equal arms. If those arms are then, if the effective distances are slightly different due to, say, the passage of a gravitational wave like that up there, then you see a certain change in length and you get a strain. Okay, so everything's based on that, except that that rolls off the tongue. But of course, I'll show you a little bit why, for Lisa, it's interesting to try to actually do it in space. Another thing that might be just useful to go through real quickly is, how big might the strain be, this fractional change in length, for a typical Lisa source? And actually, it comes out to be quite an interesting, quite a simple, back of the envelope calculation. All you have to do to get the strain for a typical source is take four times the dimensionless gravitational potential, gmr over c squared, where m then is the mass equivalent of the non-spherical kinetic energy of the source. Okay, and so typically you have a binary. Okay, so m then, the mass equivalent is about mc squared, okay, for the binary. So you take your favorite binary, so you take this 10 to the 6 solar mass black hole, you put in a distance of, say, 10 gigaparsec, you put in, you all know, 4g and mc squared, and you get about 10 to the minus 18. So one thing that's nice about gravitational wave astronomy is, you know, you can all do your back of the envelope calculations and just get your strains out and see what they are. And the thing is that indeed you do, at a fairly large distance, get a strain of 10 to the minus 18th for a supermassive black hole merger. And LISA is looking at having noise levels on the order of 10 to the minus 21 to 10 to the minus 23 in strain, which means that, you know, there will be signal noises for LISA of about 1,000 or more for supermassive black hole mergers. Okay, so you can see that right away, right off of a very simple back of the envelope calculation. Okay, so another thing, you know, is, well, what's the difference between ground-based astronomy, gravitational wave astronomy, and space-based? And so the slide we always show then is this one. And I show this because especially if you go to Washington, they see all gravitational wave astronomy as the same thing. It's all one thing right now. But really, the difference in wavelength and frequency range we're talking about is really about the difference between X-ray astronomy and infrared astronomy. And because of that, you expect to see different sources and also have really different measuring techniques. So basically, LIGO is looking for things like neutron star, and black hole coalescence, but stellar mass neutron stars and stellar mass black holes. It's looking for things like rotating neutron stars. LISA being much lower frequency, so it spans the range from about a tenth of a millihertz up to about a tenth of a hertz, goes after a whole different class of objects, coalescence of very massive black holes. It goes after galactic binaries, so these are stellar mass, but typically white dwarf binaries. And also, as I mentioned, one of its sources is in spiral of stellar mass compact objects into large massive black holes. Yeah?
There's a simple explanation of what causes the oscillation at around the tenth of a hertz.
Right. And when I go into that, I've got a slide sort of on just sensitivity, and I'll talk about that. Yeah, that's the... It's actually that the wavelength of the gravitational waves is becoming shorter than the arm length. Okay, so it's just that's exactly what's happening.
I have a question as well.
Yeah.
The maximum sensitivity of both of the instruments you showed is almost the same. I mean, it's the same order of magnitude.
Right.
Is it just coincidence, the bottom of those curves, or so?
Yeah.
It's just coincidence.
Yeah. Yeah. It turns out that with current technology, both in space and on the ground, you can get about to the same level. But in many ways, it's just coincidence. Okay, so for those of you who haven't seen much of LISA, I can go through this fairly quickly. But what LISA wants to do is have a triangular constellation of spacecraft. But you can't just put a spacecraft out there in a triangle, in any old triangle, and they won't sit there. Okay, they'll go apart from each other. So there are certain orbits that are elliptical around the sun, such that if you place the spacecraft in elliptical orbits, each one out of phase from the other one by about 120 degrees around the sun, they tend to look like they're forming an equilateral triangle that's rotating in space. Okay, but each one is just free falling around the sun. Okay. So that's a way of keeping them the satellites roughly the same distance apart from each other, but the answer is only roughly. So the distances do vary by about 10,000 kilometers, and that may not seem like much out of 5 million kilometers, but we're trying to do picometer interferometry while they're changing by 10,000 kilometers.
Just how great is the
moon? Let's see. I don't know. Who knows what the distance of the moon from the Earth? You know. Probably no one here knows that. So, I don't know. What's that? Half a million kilometers. Okay. Yeah. So one of the things, by the way, is why is it 20 degrees behind the Earth? Well, it's 20 degrees behind the Earth to get away from the influence of the moon, the Earth-Moon system, and that variation. Okay, so that actually what sets it. So you want as close as possible, but just because of communication, but you want it far enough away that the Earth-Moon system isn't perturbing. Okay, so a couple things then. There were some questions in some of the seminars here about determining source directions. And the bottom line about source directions is that you can get them to about 1 degree with LISA. And you can do it in two different ways, their AM and FM. So FM is just that as you have the LISA in orbit around the sun, you're going to be seeing a source, and there's going to be Doppler shifts in the apparent velocity of the source, if it's long enough lived, as the array moves around the sun. This is the same thing that pulsar timing does. Okay, so we get pulsar timing positions by essentially seeing the changes as the Earth goes around the sun in 1 year. So it's exactly the same as, or very analogous to pulsar timing. And that works for sources that are gravitational wave sources that have frequencies greater than about a millihertz. Okay, below a millihertz, that doesn't work too well. Basically, why? The wavelengths are becoming too long, and you're not getting very good angular resolution. So then you do amplitude modulation, and you can think of this array as having a certain antenna pattern. And here they are, the two antenna patterns for the plus and the cross polarization. And then, as then the antenna then appears, or the array appears then to move around the around in the sky, these antenna patterns then are pointing in different directions. You get an amplitude modulation of the source. And for sources that are less than about a millihertz, that gives you the best resolution. And for the strongest sources, which are things like the the massive black hole systems, you also, because of their very high signal noise, you also get about 1 degree a resolution or so. Okay, so that's a direction. One nice thing about gravitational wave astronomy is that, and it's different than almost all other areas of astronomy, and almost all other areas of astronomy, you really struggle, right, to get a distance. Okay, you look out there, you don't know how far away the thing is. Gravitational wave sources, because they're what we're interested in is mainly one object orbiting another, almost all of them come with their own self-calibrating distance metric in them. And so if you have a binary system with orbital evolution, in other words, if the frequency of the orbit is changing due to the loss of gravitational waves, these are what we call tripping sources. Basically, you have the strain of the source being dependent on something called the chirp mass, which is just a combination of the masses of the two objects orbiting each other, and a certain function of frequency. And you also have that the rate of change in the frequency of the gravitational waves is also dependent on that same chirp mass. So what you can do then is by measuring the rate of change, you can get the chirp mass, you can take it out of this formula, and then you get the distance. Okay, so all binary sources with evolution purely due to gravitational waves then give you a luminosity distance, and so you can measure then the distance to sources essentially just by looking at the frequency evolution and the strain. And typically distances are about 1%, but sometimes better, sometimes worse. So that's very nice. Okay, so for instance, if we see a supermassive black hole merger, we'll know how far away it is. The interesting thing though is you won't know the redshift. So the perverse thing about this is every other area of astronomy you can get a redshift. Okay, here you can't get a redshift because all your information is coming from timing. Okay, and what happens is the redshift just gets mixed in with the timing. It looks like a different set of masses or whatever. So you can't get the timing out. So you can't get the redshift out. You can only get the distance. And so that's an area where people are looking right now is, let's say you did have a supermassive black hole merger. Let's say you saw it 2 months before merger with LISA and you started tracking it and you got a distance to it. Okay, then you would know approximately to within, say, perhaps a fraction of a degree on the sky and to within 1% in distance. And then could you find then a counterpart electromagnetically? If you could, then you could actually do then interesting comparison of redshift, okay, to distance because you measure the distance directly. But unfortunately, you have to have that electromagnetic emission in order to be able to do that trick. But so this is a very powerful aspect of gravitational waves. Yeah.
Is there a simple way to understand the scaling, the 5/3 power chirp mass? How should we interpret the chirp mass?
Is there a simple way to do it? So, I don't think I can give you the 5/3 just from the back of the envelope. The chirp mass certainly has, you know, a power. I believe it is. What is it? Is it 2/3 of the reduced mass? So you expect the reduced mass to be part of this.
This goes back to the equation you wrote previously.
Yeah.
So you just put it in the quadrupole.
Yeah.
You'll get this formula from the.
Right. I don't think I can give you a sort of a.
The chirp mass is a funny combination of the two masses.
Yeah, I don't think I can give you the 5/3 though, and I can't give you exactly, you know. So chirp masses, you can think of the chirp mass as a combination of the reduced mass, which you expect to be important, and also the total mass, which you also expect to be important. I can't give you the exponents that make the, you know, don't have a simple. Lars, why don't you think of a simple.
It's a great exercise.
Yeah. So somebody here, think of how you get the exponents of the 5/3 and the exponents within the chirp mass while I'm talking here, and I can't do it in real time though. So, okay. Good question. Thank you. So polarization. I won't spend much on this, but much time on this, but just to say the obvious, perhaps, is that you have an interferometer, and if you think of this as a set of Michelson interferometers, say one Michelson, another Michelson, and another Michelson, not all independent, but three different Michelsons, it should be pretty obvious that you could somehow unravel and pull out the plus and the cross polarization on that.
Could you put a limit on a possible scalar component to the wave, differential scalar?
It's a good question. I think the answer is yes, but it's actually a very interesting question because there's this comment down here about Gram-Schmidt orthogonalization. Basically, when you analyze LISA, you find that it has three measurable quantities that come out of it as a data stream. And when you do this orthogonalization, two of them are polarizations, and the third one, I think, is probably somewhat sensitive, but I'm not sure about that, and my guess is it's rather insensitive, even though it is, you know, it could respond to scale. But we should talk about that if you're interested. But it's an interesting speculation, one I've wondered about.
If you get a positive result, you will get a
result. Yeah, but I don't think you're... I don't think it's going to happen because let me.
Okay.
Yeah. No. Actually, one thing that's important is that I won't go into it here. But LISA does have three modes. Two of them are polarizations. The other one is rather insensitive to just standard gravitational waves. Okay. Which is nice because we can use that one to calibrate the instrument noise. Okay. And therefore, if you have then a diffuse distribution of emission, you can actually hope to tell the difference between that, if it's a real gravitational wave background, and an instrumental background. So that third mode is very important. But I don't have any slides on that. So this gets down to answering your question. Okay. So this is then the sensitivity of LISA, and I've just drawn it here. Essentially in a square root of this strain power spectrum. Again, LISA goes roughly from about a tenth of a millihertz up to about a hertz. The sensitivity limited by three different, well, it has three different regimes. First of all, it has this regime where the sensitivity is limited by what we call acceleration noise or force noise. So these are just the small disturbances on the test masses, okay? Bound to be disturbances. A cosmic ray hits the test mass, okay? The test mass is being read out electrostatically, okay? There's essentially then a little bit of extra electrostatic repulsion or attraction of the proof mass. There's some noise on it. And there are thermal noise. There's a little bit of residual gas. All those kinds of things. The estimate is that this is the noise on the residual noise on the proof mass. This floor is essentially determined by shot noise. So once you have the size of the laser and you have the size of the mirrors, you pretty much know where that floor is, okay? Because you just count numbers of photons per unit time and you get this floor. So if LISA were operating in a regime where the gravitational waves were always longer or larger than the array itself, this thing would just stay flat out that way. However, as you go towards a higher and higher frequency or a shorter wavelength, essentially you can think of it as that you're packing a number of wavelengths into the arm, and they're just coming in plus or minus, except for that fractional wavelength at the end. Right? Okay, so what you're seeing here, the reason why this thing is wiggling, you're seeing that fractional wavelength averaged over the sky, sort of getting, of going between almost exactly a fractional wavelength into the arm length and in and out. Okay, so that's what this is. If you show this for one direction, just a single direction in the sky, this becomes actually rather extreme, these excursions. But this is average, sky average. So does that answer your question? Okay. Okay, so one thing, though, that's interesting is that here we are in, 2004, and nobody's seen a gravitational wave source, but LISA expects to be actually source-dominated over a good portion of the spectrum. In fact, the white dwarf background, an unresolvable background of white dwarf binaries, should dominate, actually, the noise level in this region from below about 10 millihertz, between about 10 millihertz and a fraction of a millihertz.
This is unresolvable, so how would you distinguish that from a uncertainty?
What's that?
How would you distinguish it from that?
Okay, actually, unfortunately, I don't have that plot around, but one of these three modes of LISA that you can break the data stream down into is very insensitive to gravitational waves. Okay, so the other two modes should pick up this background and show it, even though it's unresolvable. But that third mode should be very insensitive to it.
There are no systematic modes known that mimic none in that other direction.
I wouldn't say no, but no significant. Yeah.
Okay. What information do you get out of the spectrum from the background itself? For example, why is there that kink?
Yeah, okay, so first of all, Lars, you should actually say that, but first of all, one of the things about the kink is there just because basically that's when you start resolving individual sources, and that's very sharp, you can imagine, is that basically when you get to a point when there's only about one source per unit frequency bin, the unresolvable background really starts falling off very, very quickly.
There must be some assumption about the population.
Yes, right, so. Indeed, right. And let's see, can I characterize that quickly? There are definitely assumptions about the population. I don't know if I can give a sort of a simple sort of, can you ask maybe a more specific question?
Those are just not galactic white dwarfs.
No, those are just galactic.
Integrated.
No, those are just galactic. In fact, the extragalactic are sort of coming right down around there.
Okay, so a high frequency given extragalactic.
Yeah. But this is basically just galactic. Okay. And let's see. I don't think there's anything special about this population. It's fairly standard stuff.
The hope would be that by the time LISA's launched, we'd know much more about this population from.
Yeah. You see white dwarf binaries, you make extrapolations for when they're going to start getting close enough to actually start losing, have a significant, get into this region via gravitational radiation. You just do that calculation, you get the population, you get a certain input rate into that, and then a certain output rate when actually they go through their entire cycle and go back out again. Okay, and that's the calculation you do. Certainly, this should be directional. So this should not be isotropic. You expect it to be predominantly from the plane of the galaxy. I'll show you perhaps a little bit later, if we get to it, that one of the interesting things about LISA is that for sources above about this point, you can see all of them in the galaxy. Okay, and so one nice thing about that, put together with the fact that you can measure the distance to those guys in general, because they're close enough that you see the frequency evolution. And if there's nothing else other than gravitational orbital evolution, you can find the distance, and therefore you can get a map of the galaxy for all the ultra compact binaries, which is actually quite nice.
Okay. It looks like your body mass right there is 20, right? Degrees.
Yeah, in these units, right?
How does that relate to stream?
Right. Okay. So basically, what you have to do then is to do this in strain units. Basically, let's say you had a continuous source on that was on, and just a binary that wasn't evolving, and which is on at a certain frequency. Basically, this level divided by the square root of the time in seconds. Okay, because this is in hertz, gives you the strain level that you can get to. Okay, so if you take like this point, which is 10 minus 20, and you go for a million seconds, a fraction of a year, you put that down at 10 minus 23. Okay? Okay.
But then what sense of, you gave estimates of the strain sensitivity of the
thing. Right, that, 10 minus 21, 10 minus 23, so that's kind of,
Is that set by the limit of observation every year?
So it's set by a number of things. First of all, by the way, why do we choose these particular units? We often choose because they're time independent, so we don't have to put down an observation time. You can do your own calculation. But the other units, they're very rough. Okay. nominal, there's no consumables for Lisa. So Lisa, you know, if it keeps on working and there's no failure of components, will gracefully degrade. And what happens is that that triangular constellation I talked about slowly degrades over time. You know, the orbits evolve and they start to, the changes in distance start getting to be more than 10,000 kilometers. You start getting Doppler shifts during certain parts of the orbit that are difficult to handle, because they're large enough that it's hard to do the interferometry and so forth.
So there's no spacecraft
station keeping? No. Well, there is spacecraft station keeping, but there's no proof mass station keeping. Okay, so there are little masses that sit inside the spacecraft, and they just free fall around the sun. And you never try to touch those, but you try to fly the spacecraft around them to 10 nanometers.
No consumables in that.
Yes, there are thrusters, but the amount of thrust propellant you need to keep something just following a freely falling proof mass is not that big. But the problem there is more that you have to do it to within 10 nanometers. So.
It doesn't set a lifetime based on the thruster.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. So there are other things that we worried about as far as thruster lifetime, but running out of propellant is not one of them.
So what causes the thing to degrade if they're all just free?
I think it's Jupiter eventually, and some of the other planets eventually just cause the thing to slowly evolve out. And some people are still kind of pushing at this, saying, okay, do we have the right orbits? Can we find one that doesn't evolve quite as much? It'll last 5-10 years and get good measurements for 5-10 years before.
So the orbits are not being fixed. People are still looking for it?
Not absolutely. So
orbit.
What's that? No. Certainly these orbits work, but orbital mechanics is actually an interesting subject, especially when it's a multi-body. So, I would say that, my guess is probably we're pretty close to what the best one, but is it the best one? I don't know. Okay, so how are we doing on time? So does anybody want to hear about capabilities, or this actually you may know more about capabilities. So this may be actually better to talk about how some of the things and how it's done. Let me just go through those because it's probably something you may not hear quite as much about. So this is now starting to take the lid off the spacecraft and look inside. It's not that big of a spacecraft. The spacecraft itself is about the diameter of it is about that big. So it's not that big of a spacecraft. These mirrors are 30 centimeters. Same mirrors are used for sending the beam out and receiving the beam back, from the distant spacecraft. One thing, though, you should think about, though, is that we glibly say this is like a Michelson interferometer. So one problem here is that when you send the beam out and it comes back, that spacecraft isn't in the same place anymore because it's 35 seconds later, and 35 seconds of Earth orbit time is a big distance. Okay. So that's one of the minor things we have to worry about is that you've got a Michelson and all of a sudden you're if it was like the LIGO, central station just moved, 10 meters to the right, that's something we have to deal with.
How big is the beam when it comes back?
It's a diffraction limit of 1 micron light length with a 30 centimeter diameter telescope. So whatever that is. Yeah. And somebody can tell me what it is.
10⁵, so it's, yeah. And you're what, 10 to the 6 kilometers?
Yeah. So that's one thing is that it's a big spot on the distant spacecraft.
Bigger than spacecraft.
Much bigger than the spacecraft. But one thing that we have to be very careful about is the uniformity of that wavefront at that distant spacecraft. Okay, so that's one of the things we worry about, is that the optics has to be good enough so that wavefront on that distant spacecraft is not varying too much.
You don't have to point the lasers?
Yes, we do have to point. In fact, to a mere 3 nanoradians per word hertz. This is fun whenever you give this talk because it opens up 10 new talks as we unfold here. So that sounds crazy if you're an astronomer looking at stars. But the nice thing is you have a very nice star to track on, which is the distant spacecraft. It's really quite bright. You know exactly its wavelength, and so it's the feedback on that distant spacecraft star, which is very unique, that you use then to achieve this very high precision, and you get the thing way away from the Earth, so there's no perturbations, and that's the magic of doing this.
Are these free running lasers, or are you trying to frequency lock them?
So you can imagine that this whole system, you can think of it as either as doing very precise distance metrology or very precise timing metrology or both, okay? And the answer is both. And I can just say a little bit about that in a second. Okay, so I've already talked about flying the spacecraft. So the spacecraft then flies around that proof mass to within a few nanometers. Okay, using thrusters that I haven't shown here, so that's kind of interesting.
Is there a figure of merit measured in fraction of little g?
What's that?
Is there a figure of merit measured in fraction of little g?
Yeah, that's on the next slide. I'll show you. Okay. Yeah, indeed. Good lead into the next slide. That one I've never heard of, but. And you have to keep on going back and making sure that the right calculations were done. When you're at the levels we're at, anything. In fact, I've been worrying a little bit about the timing recently. I've been one of my current topics right now, right here at ITP, is worrying about the timing metrology between the whole arrays, and there may be relativistic effects in the timing between the different spacecraft, but I don't think so. But I want to make sure about that. In any case, much more trivial problem then is just flying the spacecraft around the proof masses to a nanometer. There's a problem though, because you can fly a spacecraft around one proof mass to a nanometer, but doing it around two when they have different orbits is a little bit different. So you have to actually tug and push on the proof mass and do it in a very special way that you don't disturb the proof masses along these axes, but push on them just in perpendicular directions. They're electrostatic, unfortunately. So I proposed actually doing it gravitationally. So by moving masses that you can pick up and you can actually see with your just moving or just a little bit of liquid change. Okay, and actually that works. It has no problem pushing them. It has not quite enough authority torque wise. But actually, I thought that was a very clean way of doing actuation of the proof masses. My colleagues didn't think much of the idea. let's see. Okay, so here's the number you asked for. So acceleration noise, we're trying to get down to about 3 times 10 minus 15 newtons per root hertz. So GPB, I don't know what GPB is. Somebody else might have that. What I can tell you is that current... The quietest environment that you can find, that you can get on the ground right now is about 100 times worse than this, about 3 times 10 minus 13. And there will be a LISA flight technology mission, hopefully that will fly in 2008, and that wants to get down about 3 times 10 to the minus 14. GPB is certainly worse than the 3 times 10 minus 14, but I'm not calibrating sort of it. It's not good enough. It's worse than certainly the technology flight demonstration. I think it's even not quite as good as the best ground quietest ground base. So you do this with a torsion balance on the ground, create a very quiet environment in one axis, and it's already been achieved to be about roughly 3 times 10 minus 13. That's something you do have to worry about. Okay. Yes. But basically the thing's pretty stable, as far as they're not moving very much, so there's not a lot there. So there are definitely lots of issues about gravitational balancing, you can imagine already. If I tell you that I can just move a little mass, to control the proof mass, better have this thing very well gravitationally balanced and very stable, a very stiff structure. So those are all kind of some of the engineering details. Okay, so I don't think I'll get into much else here. Light comes in here. Heads out through the telescope to the distance spacecraft. Light comes back from the distance telescope, and then bounces off the face of the proof mass. And you do this all with changing polarization a lot, so you have different beams going in and out with different polarizations and lots of that stuff. Okay. So let's see. Just to say something about the interferometry, you of course got a beam going in each direction. And then you have two beams going in each direction to tie the two optical assemblies together, reference-wise. And let's see. So I think this is the last slide, perhaps I'll say on instrumentation, then we can perhaps just have an open session on capabilities. So we often say that LISA is essentially Michelson interferometer in space, and indeed when you do the LISA sensitivity calculation for Michelson interferometer that's at essentially a 60 degree angle, you get a certain sensitivity, and indeed that's very close to the sensitivity we used. However, the implementation is actually quite different than a Michelson interferometer. I'll just emphasize a few points that I haven't made so far, is that you have no beam splitter here. So the equivalent of for us of a beam splitter is actually to do is to trade the laser signals back and forth between the optical benches and beat them against each other to get a reference. So that's our, in some sense, our heterodyne beam splitter. There are no end mirrors, so you aren't bouncing light off the distant spacecraft. If you know the spot at the distant spacecraft is huge. If you tried to bounce light back, you'd never get enough light back to do anything. So instead of a mirror back there, you have you build the equivalent of a transponder. So you take the laser signal, you beat it with an onboard reference at that distant spacecraft, lock another laser to it, and send that laser back. Okay. So it's not like Michelson where you send light out, it bounces off an end mirror and comes back. It might look like that. That's not what's happening. You send light out, it's actually heterodyne in that distance spacecraft, and then you send another laser signal out that's locked to that distant spacecraft, all the time with all this Doppler stuff going on between the spacecraft.
Is the third arm essential, or is it just...
So the third arm is not essential. So if you lost one of the arms, you could still do gravitational wave measurements. You'd lose two things, though. You'd lose your polarization capability, and you'd also lose this third mode that allows you to distinguish cosmic background from instrumental background. Okay. So the arms are, again, varying by as much as 10,000 kilometers. The arms length change by about 1 meter per second. Remember, you're trying to do sort of picometer interferometry with arms that are changing at about a meter per second. That's gutsy. Light travel time is 17 seconds, okay, so the time it takes for the light to get here, to be transponded and come back is 34 seconds. That causes a lot of issues and problems because, like I said, the spacecraft is no longer at its same position when the light comes back. Another way of saying that is constellations constantly rotating and translating in space, so you have to deal with all those translations and rotations. So I think at this point, I will stop with a prepared presentation and just take questions about capabilities. So I have lots of slides. I can talk about any of the science topics, any of the four science topics mentioned at the beginning, the black hole mergers, the capture of stellar mass black holes by massive black holes in centers of galaxies, can talk a little bit about the binary population, can even say a few words about the primordial gravitational radiation, but nothing that's that interesting, I think.
What's so. The data rate?
Data rate's very low, okay? So since we're only measuring up to 1 hertz, we really only need a data stream that goes up to about 10 hertz. So one thing about LISA is that at the time that when LISA flies, I am convinced that the data you'll take it, you'll either wear it on your wristwatch or have it in your pocket, and, the entire data set. So just won't be a big deal. You're already close now. So
how are you getting these things up there?
You get up there with a rocket, okay? Okay. Don't have that slide, but you stack the three. Yeah, you do have to be a rocket scientist. Yeah. So you stack the three in a pancake type configuration. Those three disks that I showed you, plus each of those disks has a propulsion module, okay, on the back of it, because it has to deliver it to the right orbit and right phase with the right velocity. Okay, so you take all three of them up there at once. You then use those propulsion modules to slowly, it takes over a year, to place them in their correct orbits. Then you drop the propulsion modules. Okay, you kick them away because you don't want those propulsion modules around. If it's liquid propellant, you just don't want that sloshing around at all. So you get rid of them. Okay, and then you and you do a very careful insertion of the spacecraft into orbit around the sun.
Separating the modules from the carrier spacecraft?
Yeah, there is a bit. You have to do that carefully because, with the, so.
Okay.
How long is the satellite, one of these, last? What's the life expectancy?
Well, you know, that's, like I said, you know, effectively, as far as once they're delivered to their orbit, you know, it takes nothing to put a little bit of extra low thrust propellant on there. So it's the life expectancy is really set by the duration to which you can have an orbit that's useful, as far as its ability to stay in a triangular configuration.
How about, like, if you lose one of them, is there any way you can replace one?
Yes. So there's been. Yeah. So there's definitely been talk or consideration of building four. A spacecraft. Yeah, in some ways, you know, actually having seen the Mars Exploration Rovers, there's a lot of advantage to building one more thing than you think you absolutely need, because it actually helps you on schedule and lots of other things. If there's a failure component, you just, you know, take a subsystem, put it in the one you're trying to get.
Would you put the fourth on the other side?
A TBD, you know, so there's discussions about this. So some people say, okay, put it in the middle. Some people say, you know, put it near one of the arms, you know, don't know. You know. Other people say, you know, hold it back, you know, launch it later. So not defined. It's a good question, though. Yeah, so.
Can you say anything about the primordial
process? Okay. Yeah, I can say something about it, but I'm not sure I can do anything interesting. Why don't we? I can tell you what we can't do more than what we can do. So. Okay. Yeah. Okay. You don't want to see that. Okay. So first of all, I'll show you a picture, and then I'll show you some words. So this is a very busy plot. Okay, it's in terms of, you can think of this as that square root of the strain noise spectrum, and it's multiplied by f. So this is somewhat like if you take 1 over f, that's a period. So you're sort of dividing by a time, which it's square root of the time where the time is defined by the period. So this is for an object that those are kind of the units over there. But in any case, here's LISA way up here, okay, like that. And this is the standard model right now for the thought about scale invariant production of gravitational waves.
But that's very dependent on lots of assumptions.
Right. Right. Indeed. And so the next slide, you know, if we choose to show, we'll say, you know, you're extrapolating over 15 orders of magnitude and flapping, you know, arms a lot. But you know, and that's true, right? So it is a very but if you just take, you know, sort of the standard picture, extrapolate out 15 orders of magnitude, it's way below the LISA wavelength, LISA sensitivity limit.
But Tom, if I remember right, if you have a flat power spectrum, which I think this is, given you're multiplying it by f, it's not equal power per decade. But the question I was going to ask is, pulsar timing at much lower frequencies, I always thought was the place where you get the biggest constraint on the primordial gravitational waves rather than LISA or LIGO.
I think that may be right.
If it has a certain power spectrum.
Yeah, because basically the reason for that is that you can kind of see what's happening. So here's advanced LIGO. You know, if you apply current LIGO, it's about up here. Pulsar timing is kind of over here, and it's not quite as good as these two, but it's up a bit. So this guy starts running, you know, getting closer to those. You can kind of just see it off the plot here. So I think you're right, but I think that the as far as the primordial background, what LISA can do is open up a large phase space that has not been looked at yet, and look for new physics. Okay, physics that's different than, you know, just sort of the conventional model, is I think the way to say it. Okay, and it does that at a very different wavelength than the wavelengths that are being probed by the cosmic microwave background. Okay. But by the way, people in the community are scheming, you know, although it's you know, you've seen how hard LISA is experimentally, and you know, people are talking about trying to build a mission that actually can measure this. Okay, but yeah,
that's BBO.
Big Bang Observer. Yeah. But I have intellectual interest in that, but as far as I think it's only sort of intellectual, and sometimes it's a thought experiment right now for me. It's not real.
BBO many leases?
BBO is several leases, not a ton of them. I think it's instead of three spacecraft, I don't know what the, I forget the number, 9 to 12, something like that. So you essentially form one of the big backgrounds is you can kind of see it floating around here. Are once you start going into this range, you can actually build instruments that can start seeing just about all the compact binaries in the universe. And so in order then, if you want to get down to this level, you have to subtract out all those compact binaries. One way to do that is not to have just one LISA configuration, but have several of them, if you still use the Earth's orbit. So you can essentially do interferometry across the Earth's orbit. You're helped by the fact that you're operating at higher frequencies, so your wavelengths are smaller, so you can have better angular resolution. And so it's a constellation of constellations that, at least in the thought experiment, allows you then to resolve out the compact binary background. But, for many of us, that compact binary background itself would be quite interesting if you could see essentially all the compact binaries in the universe. So you'd see all the neutron star, double neutron star binaries.
Is the many orders of magnitude increase in sensitivity due to the larger arm
length? No, not so much. So to get down here, let's just look at this at about, these units, 10 to the minus 21. One could easily think, of lasers that had 100 times, 100 times brighter, even, 1,000 times brighter. That would bring you down to here, as far as that basic level. You could think instead of, 30 centimeter telescopes, you could think of, 1 meter or larger telescopes. Okay, that brings you down a little bit. So you're already then, the BBO, the equivalent BBO to LISA is this curve here. Okay, so you can easily imagine that, you could kind of bring down this level, which is the shot noise, as I was talking about, to this level by, just doing more power, bigger mirrors, and so forth. The key thing, though, is, can you control all the...
I'm sorry, I was looking at the bottom of the green. Right?
Yeah, so this is...
that's the ITP version.
Yeah. I wanted to ask about the resistance of the... something about the lines, what you just said.
I cut that?
I just wanted to ask
right.
You to say something about the fault
missions. Yeah. So this one isn't a fault mission. This has to do with doing a correlation analysis. Okay. So if you know how LIGO does its observations of the cosmic background, does it by correlating the signals or LIGO versus other observatories. Okay, and doing that correlation, that's how you actually best measure a background. And this is then the result of that correlation analysis. This curve, and I just threw this together today, so I haven't gone back through and gotten every curve in my head. This curve is much more like using LISA in the standard way. But you can imagine that if you have two arrays, on sort of opposite sides of the sun, you can start correlating them. And so that's this green curve, and then this black curve is sort of using the thing as a more of a standard LISA type mode, where you resolving a back a binary synthesis.
What are the sort of technological milestones that, between where we are now and where you're going to be when you put those three
right
guys in space?
Okay, so interestingly enough, just October 1st is when LISA started in the U.S. as a project. Okay, so before this, we've been a pre-project. We entered what NASA calls Phase A, which makes it an official project of NASA now. So that's a big step. Now what we need is a budget to go along with that step. but first of all, the first step to getting a budget is actually become a project so you can be funded at that next step. So as far as the technology is concerned, there is right now, actually going on right today, a critical design review for a test package. And I won't get the slide, I can show it to you later. But what the plan is in 2008 to send a satellite, single satellite, that contains two sets of two proof masses. So one instrument with two proof masses and an interferometer combined, sort of looking at their relative displacement from the US and one from Europe. Okay, so two sets of two. And the idea then is to look at disturbances between those two proof masses that are not in sometimes common mode disturbances, so differential mode disturbances. And it's hoped then that one can then demonstrate to within a factor of 10 of the LISA force noise environment. So that's probably the biggest technology step. Beyond that, there's the issue of how do you do picometer interferometry in space. The SIM mission, Space Interferometry Mission, which is currently going, already has test beds which are operating at that level. So the feeling is that the interferometry itself is not, you know, is going to be, there's going to be a good technology of that from the SIM project. And really what the concentration is then is on the very low force noise environment. And also the thrusters I talked about are very important and have not been demonstrated yet. So it's a very important technology. The thrusters that keep the spacecraft very, very accurately around the, so this little spacecraft will try to fly drag free around those proof masses, just as LISA will, and to within about the same accuracy. So those are the sort of the big technologies. So there's lots of others, but those are kind of high points.
If you eliminate the problems that LIGO has with seismic isolation,
yeah,
there's a lot of their problems.
Right.
And you can extrapolate their problems other than seismic isolation. So
if you could somehow turn off the seismic noise entirely, then you'd be left with an arm length question, right?
When you say LIGO was successful, is that for the issue related to seismic isolation?
So maybe I don't quite understand the question. Okay.
There's lessons to be learned from LIGO.
Right.
Because I understand many lessons relate to issues that are very complicated with seismic isolation.
Right.
But beyond that, when you say there are lessons,
oh, okay. Let's see. There are some materials issues that are important, stability of materials, I think, that are important. Unfortunately, what comes to mind is lessons rediscovered or not learned from LIGO. You know, it's kind of funny that even though there are definitely LIGO people, you know, especially on the European side, working on LISA, there were some lessons there from LIGO that we should have seen quicker on LISA, which actually improved things. So I'm trying to think of other issues. So materials is a big issue. So just the fact of, you know, showed you, you know, a diagram. You build an optical bench, and you want to put then an optical element very precisely in a certain place on that, and have it be stable for long periods of time. So LIGO is very interested in that. Okay. And building very stable optical benches, and of course that's critical for LISA. So that's one area, definitely, absolutely, that comes in right away. I'm trying to think of others. Very stable lasers are also of an interest. It's a little bit different with LISA, but definitely as Carsten Dansman, who does a lot of the laser work for LIGO. Okay, and it works on the GEO 600 project in Europe. Is the same group that will probably eventually provide the lasers for LISA. So I think there's definitely a cross fertilization laser area. So lasers and materials are the two that I can think of right away.
Okay, last question.
What is the prognosis? I don't know. For getting science out of LIGO, is it around the corner? Is it next month?
So I can give you my own personal bet. And so I have bet against any detection by initial LIGO, but I've bet for detection by advanced LIGO.
And when's advanced LIGO
come on? So advanced LIGO is right now being considered for funding, okay, as a funding increment. It aims for about a 10 times improvement in sensitivity, which, you know, first order roughly, that about increases the rate by a factor of 10 cubed. And I think, and my own personal feeling is that once you enter that regime, someplace in that regime, you'll start seeing the stellar mass black hole coalescences. So.
I think the first really good science run starts in January.
What's that?
Doesn't the first really good science run start in January?
They've been having science runs.
No, I know, but there's one month, 6 months.
Yeah, there's a long one. Okay. And, you know, and who knows, you know, maybe something will pop out there. Again, I've actually had bets on record and not, but that's just a bet, right? So, yeah. You know, I don't know, you know, I worked on LIGO for a little while and tried to do, you know, see where I would place my bets for astrophysical sources. And it wasn't clear that there was a winner, absolute winner there. So.
Great. So Tom's here for another few months.
Yeah.
I encourage everybody to talk
yeah.
to him.
Yeah. Yeah. Please talk to me so I can stay away from my other duties. I like to be a skeptic.